From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's USDA Report Day, July the 9th, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the agricultural futures markets with Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. Later in the program, Daryl Good will join us to take up the USDA reports released this morning, in particular the WASD numbers as they relate to corn and soybeans. And as we move through to the second part of our program, we call that the farming world, and you can hear it on many of these radio stations or online at willag.org. We'll discuss the price of farmland across the nation with Roger Hayworth of Farmers National. And it all happens on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
In Chicago on this Friday afternoon, futures finished the day with the wheat futures lower, down 10.5 cents in the July at 523.5. For the soft red, September at 538, down 10.5, and December contract at 566.5, down 10.5 cents. July hard red in Kansas City at 548.25, down 5.75. July corn futures, 375.25, 2.25 lower. September at 383.5, down 2. December at 395.25, down 1. The March at $4.07, a penny lower, and the May futures at $4.15, down 0.75. July beans at $10.25.5, up 13 on the day. August futures $9.93.25, up 10.25, and September soybeans at $9.66.5, 9 cents higher. November futures $9.53.25, up 7.25 cents. January contract at $9.62.25 for next year, and the bean pit 7.5 cents higher. July bean meal at $3.14.10, up $3.70. The August at $300.90, up $3.30. July bean oil at $37.38, up 52. August live cattle futures $90.20, down 70. August feeder cattle at $113.20 were up 40 cents on the afternoon. And the July lean hogs today at $78.62.5 per 100 pounds. They finished the day down 25 cents. That all at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, their Board of Trade on the livestock and the grains and oil seed side. In just a few moments, we'll talk with Mike Zuzolo about the agricultural futures markets and those WASDE numbers that were released this morning from the United States Department of Agriculture. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. August crude oil futures, $76.25 a barrel, 81 cents higher. The fuel ethanol at $1.59.5, down 8 tenths of a cent. Natural gas at $4.41.9, up 2 cents for the day. And the heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.03, 2 4 tenths of a cent higher. Gold futures at $1,209.60 an ounce, up $13.80. That's the settlement price in the Dow now, just about 30 points higher at $10,169. The U.S. dollar at 83.94 is up 0.12, and the CRB index at 260.62 is 1.1 higher. The Goldman Sachs, 501.20. That's 3.7 higher on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the Midwest looks like as it comes from Drew Lerner at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City, Missouri. He says welcome rain overnight from central Illinois to Michigan and Ohio offered some short-term relief for a bit of dryness that had come along with the recent warm weather. Additional showers will occur, he says, in the eastern Midwest today. That'll favor Kentucky and Ohio, but some lighter showers in eastern and southern Illinois and Indiana may occur as well. The next round of significant rain, says Mr. Lerner, will occur Sunday into Tuesday, but rain amounts during that time period will be fairly erratic. Temperatures will be seasonable. The second week forecast brings less rain, warmer temperatures to the Midwest. A high pressure ridge will develop in the plains and the western Corn Belt July 16th through the 23rd. That'll be responsible for reducing rain and heating things up again. Rain should occur frequently in the second week of the outlook from the northern plains to the Great Lakes region. We'll take a more complete look at the nearby forecast at the bottom of the hour when we talk with Steve Hilberg at the Midwestern Regional Climate Center.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
On this Friday afternoon, time to check the agricultural futures markets. Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting joins us by phone. Thanks, Mike, for being with us.
You bet, Todd. Happy Friday to you, my man.
Happy Friday to you as well. Well, the numbers came in from USDA this morning, and we'll go through them in complete detail with Daryl Good in just a few moments. What did you see as highlights you'd like to discuss this afternoon?
Oh, I suppose probably the biggest thing was the way the beans reacted to what I thought was mostly a neutral to slightly negative report, in that the 09 ending stocks came in a little bit higher at 175 for 09 beans. The fact that the USDA actually raised 2010 planted acres and kept the yields the same, and kept the ending stocks up there around 360 million bushels, I felt like the trade was probably trying to price in a bit lower than that for a 2010 carryover, maybe as low as a 295, 285 level, Todd, at the price levels that we were trading going into the report. And so the way the trade was able to shrug that off and head higher was impressive to me. I guess the wheat market did what I expected, except that I think both wheat and corn could have gone down probably double, and in some cases, like the corn. I think the wheat probably could have moved down 25 to 30 cents today after the report because of the move that it had had going into the report, and that probably would have allowed the corn to break 8 or 9 cents today. So without the beans supporting, I felt like that the corn and wheat had more downside. So I think the corn and wheat owe a lot to the beans after today's report.
Well, they owe a lot to the beans. But on their own, if you look at the corn numbers, USDA dropping both this year's and next year's ending stocks substantially, both under 1.5 billion now, 1.47, I think, on this year, and 1.3. Close to 1.4 on next year. Those are pretty tight stocks.
They are, and I think that, again, I think that the trade probably was expecting some of that, at least because of the residual of what happened in the June acreage and stocks report. I think the thing that it puzzles me about the corn right now is that we went from a very, very bearish mindset in the trade to now the trade is getting ramped up for a very, very bullish mindset, in my opinion. And I have no problem with that if it's led by the outside markets, but when I saw that the USDA did reduce ethanol demand for 2009 to match up with the Department of Energy numbers, which I think they should have, I think that was a good thing, but it's still worrisome. It says that our economy is not really back on the mend as much as we need it to be, and I was very surprised that they went ahead and lowered the exports on corn for 2010, especially in light of a reduced wheat factor in terms of competition and wheat, and the wheat-corn spread being up there at that 150 to 160 level, and also the idea that China was going to continue to buy. So I'm not making a big deal of it right now, but I think it's something to watch for later on. It kind of solidifies my mindset that I'm trying to promote to clients and subscribers that if there were an ideal year, and especially the second half of this marketing year, to do a sell-and-defend type model on your marketing plan, because there's so many questions and so few answers, especially when it comes to your yield and what the overall economy is going to do as we get into the late 2010, early 2011 time period. Sell it when it gets to profit, defend it, especially between now and mid-September, and kind of walk away, and don't try and get too technical, don't try and get too complex on your marketing plan at this point.
We thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, Todd, have a great day.
You too. That's Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. We're joined by Daryl Good, ag economist from the University of Illinois, to discuss this morning's world agricultural supply and demand estimates. Many changes in the corn and the soybean supply numbers, and we probably ought to talk about wheat too. Let's start with the corn and the changes that took place.
we're looking, most of the changes, Todd, that took place, I think, were driven by the June stocks and acreage reports that came out on June 30th. Those stock numbers as of June 1 were much smaller than the market anticipated. That forced the USDA now to revise upward their expectation of feed and residual use of corn this year by 175 million bushels. That was partially offset by a 50 million bushel decline in expected use for ethanol. But bottom line, they did lower their year-ending stocks projection by 125 million bushels, which takes that under 1.5 billion. That decline is probably a little less than the market expected, but I think USDA is playing it conservative until we see the actual September 1 stocks estimate. The net result was we start next year with 125 million bushels fewer corn than we forecast last month. Because of the smaller acreage number last month, USDA also lowered the production forecast by 125 million. So supply goes down 250 million from last month's projection, dropped their projection of exports by 50 million. But bottom line, inventory of September 1, 2011 is now projected 200 million smaller than a month ago, and that takes that number under 1.4 billion bushels. USDA tacked on 15 cents to their expected price range for the 2010-11 crop year, a midpoint of 385 for that crop.
It doesn't seem high enough to me, it appears, with this short of supply. You come in with a 1.478 now, a 1.373 billion carryout next year. It seems like an awfully tight supply. Sometimes we talk about this, the ag economists talk about it in number of days of available supply at the end of the year, and sometimes 28, 30 days, about a month is what's left around. What does this represent truly?
Well, we're about 10% of annual use is the projected year-ending stocks number. So, you're talking just a bit over a month of total supply expected to be left over at the end of next year. That's relatively tight for corn. But again, when we look at the projected price of $3.85, that's a full 30 cents higher than we're going to average for the 09 crop. So it is a fairly large jump in the average price, although compared to the $4 we've had in 07 and 08, $3.85 looks a little modest with smaller carryover stocks. So this is about in line with where the market is now, but it does suggest that if anything else goes wrong here on the supply side, that there probably is opportunity for this market to go even higher. And we're beginning to hear some talk now about maybe excessive June precipitation did have a bit of a negative impact on production potential. And I think a bit more worrisome is a forecast that last half of July may get really warm over much of the Corn Belt. While pollination may be fairly well completed by then, heat would put a little stress on the crop. We haven't had that for a couple of years. We've had some pretty cool summers the last 2 years. So some excessive heat, I think, would be a bit problematic and might make that 163.5 bushels that USDA is currently using. I think people are beginning to fade that number just a little bit right now. So if that's confirmed with the August production report, then this year-ending stocks projection is going to get even snugger.
Producers have turned fairly bullish to the marketplace. I think friendly probably is not the right term.
I think that really is the case. Last half of June, prices were sliding pretty hard. Everybody got really negative. The USDA June 30 reports really was a game changer. We have a very sharp rally following that. Now, as bearish as everybody was 3 weeks ago, they're as bullish now. I think we're seeing December corn push back up towards that $4 mark. I think yesterday we were at 396, 397. Seems to me that that's kind of in line with our recent high. We may have a little difficulty right now pushing above $4 December corn. But if the market does get really a little bit more worried about production, and at the same time we can hold the demand side of the market together, then you might start talking, okay, let's look at those late winter highs. Where were we before we got that really shocking January production report? And, you know, that's 40, 50 cents above where the market is right now. That seems like a long shot to get back to 4.5 D's corn. I think it would take some stress on the crop, maybe some confirmation that yields are not quite as high as we thought just a month ago.
Now, USDA's average market price tops out at 405, so that tells you 425, 430 probably, December corn, an easier target to get to?
Yeah, at the top end of USDA's range of 405, again, that's a 12-month average. That would say December corn ought to go to the 410 level or so, and then you add the carry into next summer would give you a season's average cash price of this 405 that's at the top end of the range. So, you know, it does say there's, even from USDA's numbers, they're saying 15 cents higher in the market would not be a surprise at this point.
I suppose the point here is caution and temper your bullishness.
I think so. I mean, particularly if you've got old crop corn, 3 weeks ago you thought sub $3, here we come. And now we've had a 50, 60 cent rally. It's approaching mid-July. We ought to be moving old crop corn, at least on this rally. And we're back close to the insurance price on revenue products. Not a bad place to sell a little new crop, I would think, if we didn't do that late winter last year.
Take up the soy complex for me, please.
Again, we see some of the changes in the projections being driven by USDA's June 1 stocks number. That came in a little smaller than expected. USDA now has raised their forecast of current marketing year crush and exports by 5 million bushels each, resulting in a 10 million decline in year-ending stock projection, puts that at 175 million bushels. So, again, this continues the tightness that we see in old crop soybeans. That carries over into next year. We'd have a smaller beginning stocks of soybeans, but because of the increase in acreage reported on June 30th, the production estimate went up 35 million bushels. So the net is they show a 25 million bushel increase in potential supply for next year. But that's completely offset by a 5 million bushel increase in projected crush, 20 million bushel projected increase in exports, but still leaves year-ending stocks at a 360 million bushel, kind of double what we start with. So unlike corn, where we're showing small stocks and tightening stocks, current projections would show an abundance of soybeans for next year.
And did they show global stocks on the increase too? For instance, what are the predictions for South America?
Yes. In fact, we do see some minor increases there. When we look at the total foreign stocks compared to last month, those are jumping not quite a million tons, 800,000 tons. But that is a bit smaller than where we ended, where we're going to start the year in the rest of the world. So we're seeing some building inventories in the U.S., kind of stable to slightly declining stocks in the rest of the world.
Probably accounts for the 810 to 960 range then on the average market price,
right,
which is higher than it was previously.
Right. The USDA did raise their season's average price projection by 10 cents on each end of the range, but that would put us at 885, still below what we expect average for the current marketing year. So that lower price projection does reflect some building inventory of soybeans next year.
You think producers ought to be thinking with their soybean supplies? I'm sure that there are some that look out at their soybean crop, and there are some really lousy-looking soybean fields, at least in this part of the world, and they're thinking, boy, this crop is in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, the June weather, I think, really did result in some damage to the soybean crop, a lot of ponding, a lot of late weed control in the soybean crop. I think we're getting that under control now so that perhaps things are improving a little bit. But now the concern, again, is if summer dries out and heats up, and if that does linger into August, I think that would be more of a concern for the soybean crop. So, as usual, there's always a lot of uncertainty. We don't know as much as we'd like to know. But having said that, we've had an awfully good rally in the soybean market. New crop bids are now above $9 harvest delivery. That's above USDA's midpoint of expected marketing year average price. Again, not a bad place to make a few sales, I think, given the sharp rally that we've had.
And that's Darrell Good, University of Illinois Extension Ag Economist, joining us here this afternoon on the Closing Mark Report to take a look at the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates released by the United States Department of Agriculture at 7:30 a.m. this morning. You can always hear Darrell again in the Closing Market Report online at willag.org. Or sign up for the podcast of Commodity Week. Even go to the Commodity Week page if you just want to hit Darrell. It's posted there, too. It's all at willag.org for free. Up next, talking time with Bruce Bostard. He's at the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
I went home the back way yesterday, and boy, oh boy, some of those bean fields look pretty rough here. I don't know. I suspect it's just kind of the way I went, but, man, it's a tough deal. How are things looking there?
Spotty. I mean, fields all over the place, all in all. Short, really, especially when you compare them to, in some cases, a huge cornfield next door. So they're spotty.
And then turn your attention to what happened today. Did farmers call in thinking that things were going to rally and we're pretty disappointed with what happened in the corn market?
Oh, not so much. I mean, we've had a pretty good run, so I think a little bit of a setback didn't really dampen anybody's enthusiasm too much. Through the week, last week on the rally up here, we've seen good scale-up selling into it, basically cleared up the offers that were sitting over the market, but not huge amounts.
Has basis held up pretty strong as we rally?
Basis continues to hang up really well. We are at 22 under on nearby, so we actually improved the basis a cent or two here over the course of the week. New crop has been steady. Part of that, I think, continues to be on old crop corn. There's just not a whole lot of incentive to sell an old crop train, especially if you have some quality issues on trains and you can hold off till new crop and blend it off and get rid of it 60 days from now.
How about on the soybean side? How's the basis holding up there?
We improved the nearby basis by a dime today, so that's not a bad nearby move.
Not too bad. And what are your bids on the day?
We are 10.03 on nearby beans and 9.23 for the new crop. Beans, 3.62 for nearby and 3.63 on new crop corn.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Bostard is with the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon to take a look at the cash grain market. In just a couple minutes, Steve Hilberg will be here to discuss the agricultural weather forecast. You can always visit us online at willag.org or hear us again if you'd like at this phone number, 217-333-3434. We call that our mobile analyst portal. This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
It's National Sugar Cookie Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1766, Jacob Perkins was born. Perkins was issued the first U.S. patent for a refrigerating machine. It used sulfuric ether compression. In 1792, S.L. Mitchell was named as the first professor of agriculture at Columbia College in New York City. In 1808, Samuel Parker patented the leather splitting machine. In 1815, the first natural gas well in the U.S. was discovered by accident near Charleston, West Virginia, while digging salt brine wells. In 1869, Henry Tibby invented the corncob pipe. By the way, the pipe was made from a special type of white kernel corn. that was used to make taco and tortilla flour. In 1894, Percy LeBaron Spencer was born. Spencer developed the microwave oven in 1946 after he noticed that some chocolate in his pocket had melted. Spencer deduced the candy melted not due to body heat, but rather exposure to radiation from a magnetron tube. And in 1996, Douglas Chapman died. A Canadian-born U.S. mathematical statistician, Chapman did extensive research on fish farming, and he developed quantitative methods aiding in the management of fisheries. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. Steve Hilberg at the Midwestern Regional Climate Center that belongs to NOAA, located here at the Illinois State Water Survey on the U of I campus in Urbana-Champaign, is with us to take a look at the weekend forecast and talk about the weather in the Midwest. Thanks so much for being with us, Steve.
No problem.
Well, tell me about the weekend forecast, please.
Well, we should see some improvement in the muggy conditions that we've had to experience this week. Dew points have been up in the mid-70s for a number of days this week. Not much better today over the southern portions, southern half, southern three-quarters of Illinois. But we should see some drier air gradually filter south into central and south-central Illinois. The front that moved through last night is probably going to stall out along or just south by 70 for a couple of days, and that will do two things. One, it'll probably provide a focal area for some shower and thunderstorm development in southern Illinois, but it will tend to keep at least the northern two-thirds of the state a little bit more comfortable than we have. And we're not going to see dew points in the 50s, which would be really great, but more like mid, maybe upper 60s. And then probably around that'll last for a couple of days into next week, and then we should start seeing things get a little more steamier again.
Yeah, showers were spotty. How widespread were they over the last 24 to 48 hours?
Not very. They really didn't get started yesterday until the front, at least the instability line, reached roughly this area from Champaign and Danville southwestward through Taylorville and St. Louis. So southern Illinois, there was actually some good amounts that did fall. In fact, the radar indications are that upwards of 2 to 3 inches in some isolated areas, and we have seen some actual reports of over 2 inches of rain. The coverage was pretty good down in southern Illinois, basically south of I-70, which has been a little dry for the last couple of weeks, so that was good. The rest of the state didn't get too much rain in terms of this system. Northwestern Illinois didn't, and there's this big hole over essentially central and east-central Illinois where we didn't get nearly as much rain as some of the other areas. So we could still use a little bit because despite all that rain we had in June, things turned remarkably dry, remarkably fast, it seemed, this week with the lack of rain.
Yeah, evaporative rates will be pretty strong, I suppose, even with all the humidity in the air next week.
Yeah, yes, especially the first part of the week. As we get to Wednesday or so, it does look like the warm and humid air will start spreading northward across Illinois again. That'll help keep temperatures down a little bit, and I think we'll probably see almost a daily chance for rain across Illinois next week with this front around and then some weak little disturbances coming through. Nothing organized, nothing too widespread, but with weak flow aloft, anything that develops like the last couple of days could drop some pretty good amounts of rain. So it'll be feast or famine for some folks in terms of the rain, but it looks like most of it will be most days next week.
Steve, thanks so much.
All right, Todd.
Steve Hilberg is the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center, belongs to NOAA, located here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Stay with us if you can this afternoon for the Farming World. We'll talk with Roger Hayward. He's with Farmers National in the second half of our program. You can always hear that on our website at willag.org. Otherwise, have a good weekend and be sure to tune in for Commodity Week at willag.org, posted at just about 6 o'clock this evening. I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. We're joined by Daryl.
You're listening to the Farming World
Auction of Illinois Public Media from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. On this afternoon, we're talking with Roger Hayworth. He is the Eastern Area Sales Manager for Farmers National Company. Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Hayworth. Can you tell me about Farmers National and what it has to do with real estate?
Yes, good day there, Todd. Thanks for getting myself and Farmers National Company involved today. Hopefully we can learn a little bit about land today. Farmers National Company, we're domiciled out of Omaha, Nebraska, been in business since 1929. In our territory, primarily, we are farm management and ag land sales, real estate activities, as well as we do oil and gas leasing out of our Tulsa office, and we do hunting lease networking with landowners, as well as farm appraisals throughout the United States. My territory that we cover for ag land is in Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio, and I do cover a little bit the southern part of Michigan, eastern part of Missouri, and the eastern part of Kentucky. But I handle the real estate activities within my territory here in the eastern region with Farmers National Company.
Can you take up, for instance, with me, I'm interested in the hunting lease and how you manage that. We have a large number of listeners in the southern part of Illinois and Indiana, probably some listeners by web in Missouri and maybe Michigan as well that would have properties that they would use for that type of agritourism. What do you do?
Sure, Todd. What we have is we market and sell franchises to local individuals that are entrepreneurs that would like to develop a territory. So, for instance, in southern Indiana and southern Illinois, we sell off that area to a franchisee owner who purchases that. They, in return, then put feelers out, work with landowners that may have some timber ground or hunting area or ground that they would like to put up to lease out to potential and prospective hunters out there. It's kind of like a bidding process on the website, and individuals will go online and put in bids to hunt a specific area or location or county within the region, and whoever gets the winning bid will sign up with that lease agent and sign up for a year and work out details with that person, and they would have grounds to hunt that for a period of a year's time. And all leases are a little different, but it's an interesting concept, and it has been very well received with Farmers National Company as we talk.
So the franchise has a name. So if I were interested in starting the franchise, but I'm not a landowner, you would help me do that? Is that I'm kind of the person that would manage the franchises, and you would lease that out to me?
No. What happens is that you own a franchise, and your job is then to go out and work with landowners and that may want to lease their property of 200 acres or 300 acres of timber ground.
Right, that part I understood.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but what I was suggesting is that I'm not a landowner, but I could come to you and say I want to get into this business, and I could lease the franchise. I would buy a franchise from you. I think that's probably the right term, but I'm not sure.
If the territory is available, we're looking for entrepreneurs to cover a certain part of the country. They can actually come in and negotiate out a deal with Farmers National Company and be a franchisee for a local territory, and then they would have that available for them to market the wares of putting together the lease.
Does the franchise have a name?
It's just underneath Hunting Lease Network, you bet.
Oh, under Hunting Lease Network. So then you could probably look that up under the Farmers National website?
Sure, you bet. If you go to farmersnational.com, www.farmersnational.com, you will see a part there for Hunting Lease Network. So anybody that may have interest on either a landowner that's interested in that type of maybe profitability that they're not getting currently, or if anybody might be interested in looking as ownership of a franchise. If their territory is available, they can look us up on the web and talk to our manager out in Omaha, Nebraska, and they can discuss that direct.
And I suppose, and just for clarification purpose, if I'm a landowner, I could come to, and it's farmers-national.com, and look it up, and then potentially put my land into availability as a lease so that somebody else who might be running the franchise would know that it's available? Is that possible too? Excellent.
That is correct. I mean, you know, they have capabilities of having that to be a part of their program, and they could lease that out with the bidding process and get somebody on there and be involved in it. So it's a good thing.
Okay, so let's turn our attention to a different sort of thing. So cropland in the United States in your territory. What do we know about it and how that's changed in values over the last year and a half to 2 years?
Well, I think most of the landowners out there have known that we've had some great movement in the land market over the past couple of years. And in 2008, Farmers National Company involvement, we had some record-setting sales, of course. But I think more importantly, the land market, strong market, has been increasing over these past years, of course. What we have seen in different pockets throughout the state of Illinois and Indiana, of course, we have continued to see a rise or an increase of several percentage points. 2008 was very good. We saw a little slowdown in 2009 with sales activity, but the value, land value, still continued to, especially good soil type land, continued to have increases anywhere from 5% in some areas up to 20%. Last year, we had a closed down a little bit in sales activity, but the buyer interest has definitely increased. We have lots of landowners that would like to build their portfolio up. We also have farmers that's been fairly successful over the past few years, want to increase their portfolio, and so they have been buyers out there. We've also had an influx of additional investor groups trying to hedge against inflation a little bit, so we're seeing them also being aggressive in buying land through our eastern region here to put money in there to purchase land to help develop that as well, because their rate of return is fairly solid, anywhere from 4 to 5 to 5.5% return. And that's a positive thing when you have a situation like we have in our economy right now. Again, the top soils we're seeing across the state anywhere from mid-range to above average soils, you know, close into about $5,800 to $6,500. And we're also seeing land sales on top quality or good soil types in different pockets throughout Illinois reaching at $8,000 an acre and then some. Again, it depends upon the situation. It depends on the soil types and the location that it's in. But we have not seen a downward trend whatsoever in that type of soil types in land values.
Where are those pockets of the high value soils or those $8,000 sales? Where do they come? Are they in the center part of the state and then up north, or where are we talking about?
Yeah, those pockets are, we've heard some sales of 8,000 plus around the Springfield, Illinois area. We have seen and heard up in the Galesburg, Kewaunee area. We're talking cropland type soils. They are not transitional land or building site locations. These are typical cropland acreage that's being sold out there. So, go ahead.
Are those mirrored anyplace else in, for instance, Iowa or Ohio or other places that you cover?
Sure. Well, we had a conference call, a real estate conference call this morning, actually, and a gentleman out of northwest Iowa was talking about land prices that were also reaching the $8,000 range as well. So I think as a general, we're fairly conservative in most cases. And when people ask us all the time, well, what's my land worth? Again, there's a lot of factors that go involved with trying to price out dirt with individuals. And so when you do that, you have to look at it, you know, per track basis and do an evaluation of what's happening. But as a whole, we're seeing values right now in Illinois everywhere from $6,000 to $8,000 an acre. And that's been fairly stable. I mean, it continues to be stable, but there's just not a lot of transactions taking place currently. We have a lot of buyers on the marketplace, but we don't have a lot of sellers at this point. And I think that because of a couple of trends that's taking place, I think that that's going to continue maybe this summer. But we are starting to see a little bit of activity. Again, people and individuals picking up the pressure a little bit and looking at the fall and winter for sales. And hopefully we'll see that happen.
Has the 1031 activity begun to pick up again, or is it still in a slump because of the housing problems?
I think as a whole, it definitely is in a slump. There are still 1031 monies out there. It's still floating around. There's still individual landowners that are doing 1031 exchanges amongst themselves where they're selling off certain parts of land that they had to purchase additional acreage somewhere else. But as a whole, when we looked at the 1031 money years back, it was primarily transitional ground that was sold out for a high dollar and used to purchase additional land elsewhere. That has really kind of dried up at this point because of the overall economy and marketplace. Todd, one thing I do want to mention is that we have seen definitely land or soils that are average or below average or recreational type properties. I think the economy as a whole has affected that because I don't believe that people have all the extra spending money to go out and enjoy the recreational part of land. And we're seeing some of those properties have values that are, you know, either staying stable or actually declining. In fact, the recreational ground, we're seeing in most cases, not all, but in most cases, we're seeing those struggle a little bit on the market in trying to keep pace with what they've had in the past couple of years. So if I say that there is a decline in any land values, it would probably be in that area of the arena in the land values that we're seeing some percentage droppage on that type of sales.
Would you say that will continue to happen, or is this a place that might be offer opportunity for investors for those types of soils?
Good question. I think that there is a possibility there, but I think, you know, as I said before, there's not a lot on the market. When you have the supply-demand issue, that also helps keep those rates up there, those prices up there. We have a lot of buyers, but we don't have a lot of sellers. I think if the sellers start to floodgate and start selling out, obviously you're going to see land values maybe taking a little bit of a depreciation, if you will. But as you look at recreational properties, if the economy turns around and people have a little bit more spendable income and they want to go back into the recreational side of things, then maybe that will pick up those values. But I think that that's pretty well based upon what we do as a society in our area.
Mr. Hayworth, thanks so much for spending the time with us.
You bet you. Thank you, and have a great week.
You too. Roger Hayworth is the Eastern Area Sales Manager for Farmers National Company. You've been listening to The Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Here's something of interest from the University of Illinois.
Infertility and isolation are soul sisters, says University of Illinois Professor Constance Shapiro. As friends, siblings, and co-workers effortlessly become pregnant and deliver babies, an infertile woman and her partner often feel defeated and alone. Shapiro's new book, When You're Not Expecting, has the potential to change all that by providing a sisterhood of survivors who have been there and know how it feels. The author draws on her 20 years of experience as an infertility counselor. She addresses topics such as the emotional impact of invasive medical treatments, what to do when making love becomes hard work, and putting your life on hold while you're waiting for expensive treatments to succeed. Shapiro hopes people who read her book, When You're Not Expecting, will feel validated in the emotions they themselves are having and find the women's accounts of their experiences a lifeline to sanity and survival. And that's Something of Interest from the University of Illinois.
Something of Interest is a public service of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Up next, reaching into the chicken coop for a handful of fresh eggs isn't just a farm activity. A number of cities, including Urbana, allow residents to keep fowl. Lisa Braltz talks to some urban chicken wranglers in this week's edition of In My Backyard.
A couple of weeks ago, my husband called me at the office to let me know he had just seen something I might find interesting. He was in Urbana on his way back to his office from running an errand, he said, when he spotted a woman walking down the street with her chicken. We're hardly strangers to fowl here in Urbana, Illinois. People have legally, and quietly for the most part, been keeping chickens within city limits for ages. And there have been a couple of mini explosions of urban fowl activity in the last decade. In fact, I'd say we're in the middle of one of these explosions right now. I'm sure this is due, at least in part, to enhanced awareness about where food comes from, and especially about how animals are raised before we eat them or their byproducts. I figured, though, that everyone who makes the decision to keep chickens, to take the step of bringing home these creatures that are way different than anything with, say, fur, has a good reason for it. There's a story behind it. The houses in our part of the city are quite small by current standards, but the yards are pretty generous. Some friends of ours in the neighborhood have an awesome garden situation in their backyard. Theirs is the garden that inspired me to first start growing food. This family has spent two decades filling the space with raised beds for growing vegetables, growing yet more vegetables up trellises, planting and moving perennial flowers and herbs. And the result is this incredibly rowdy, colorful, verdant, and lush space that is also totally functional. About 10 years ago, the old dog run was no longer being used, so it made sense, said one of my friends, to clean it out and add six chickens to the mix, especially since they provide food for their keepers and excellent manure for the garden, and having chickens would be a great learning experience for their then young children. However, our friends, who still have several chickens and now ducks, aren't sentimental about it. They definitely see their birds as part of their backyard food production scenario. When they outlive their usefulness, said the other of my friends, a bird's time on the tiny farmlet has come to an end. In this case, poultry aren't really seen as pets. Others, though, see them as both agricultural contributors and as pets. Another poultry arrangement in the neighborhood is between two households, and it came about suddenly when neighbors who had chickens were moving overseas. Karen Klebe was a reluctant chicken owner.
I was vehemently opposed to chickens. Sam wanted them right away when we got the house, and I was just like, no. Just no. They're smelly, they're messy, and quite honestly, I just didn't want to be those people.
We'd had this joke in our marriage that there were only two things in our prenuptial agreement. They were no chickens and no minivan.
Her husband, Sam Vandegrift, remembers it a bit differently.
We had some friends who were moving out of the country, and they'd gotten birds about a year ago, and we saw them raised from chicks up through pullets, and then they started laying eggs, and it was really awesome watching them discover what it was like to have birds and raise animals that they were going to eat something from. I remember my spouse surprised me by suggesting that we take the birds in, which I thought was really quite a transformation from where we were. Absolutely, absolutely not. And I wasn't quite sure, actually. I was suspicious. So I thought that there was actually a gold caravan on the way. So
Sam and Karen's partners in this endeavor are their next-door neighbors, Ryan Griffiths and Sarah Ross. While Sarah, who isn't really an egg eater, was pretty interested in raising chickens, Ryan, who does eat eggs, was rather indifferent to the whole idea until the chance came, he said, to inherit these ready-made chickens. They knew the coop would reside next door with Karen and Sam, but decided that in order to give the chickens more room to range, they would get out the bolt cutters and cut a hole in the fence to enable the chickens to move between yards. It's an arrangement that exists to this day, though they've had to create more fencing in order to keep the chickens from totally devouring their garden. Ryan sees the birds as occupying this in-between space. Not quite pets, but not quite farm animals either.
They're not like dogs or cats in the sense that they come into the house with you later. We don't have names for them or call them and expect them to behave in the way that you expect pets to behave or to return any kind of affection. It's not necessarily like that, but probably I would think that we worry about them probably more than most people who are raising, you know, like a larger number of chickens.
Life with chickens isn't perfect. Even though they forage all day long, they do require feeding. They need structures to live in. Predators can sometimes be a problem, and occasionally they can get sick and pass away suddenly. When one of the four ready-made chickens died without warning, Sam was really upset. He said it made him rethink his initial desire to learn how to slaughter his own birds. A couple of months later, he's still not sure he wants to. And Karen appreciates them way more than she thought she would. They're a really great cheering section when you're out working in the yard, she says. They're friendly. They'll eat anything. Plus, eggs. It kind of makes a girl want to build a coop for a few ready-made chickens in her backyard. Just don't tell my husband.
Lisa Brott's stories can also be heard on our website, willang.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com. If you have a story idea for In My Backyard, we would love to hear it. Drop us an email at willagstaff.org. That's willagstaff.org.